WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. It's been a weekend of severe weather in parts of the central and southern U.S., and more tornado watches are now in effect in parts of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia.
Heartbreaking. Never seen anything like this before.
That was the reaction from a Missouri resident surveying the damage. CBS's Jason Allen reports on some of the worst hit areas.
The storms arrived in the dark, illuminated by lightning strikes.
I had glass flying everywhere into my face and my arms and everything.
Dan Longstrom took cover inside the cab of his tractor trailer in this community west of St. Louis. His truck slammed by another truck, pushed over by the high winds. He watched as the twister blew apart a nearby gas station and restaurant.
Tons of people up in the store that were just running around crying and screaming, and it was pretty scary.
The death toll is at least 36. The high winds also fanned the flames of more than 130 wildfires burning in Oklahoma. They have damaged or destroyed at least 300 homes. Jenny Power lives in the city of Stillwater, where a lengthy cleanup is underway.
These fires everywhere feel inevitable, like they're just part of our lives now.
The White House says almost 300 members of foreign gangs were arrested and deported after President Trump signed a proclamation invoking the Alien Enemies Act. A federal judge has now blocked the deportations. CBS's Lilia Luciano with an update.
We've learned directly from the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, that a series of planes, according to the images that he's posted on social media, there's about three planes containing at least, according to him, 238 alleged Tren de Aragua gang members and another 23 MS-13 members.
At least 59 people died and 155 others were hurt in a nightclub fire during a concert in North Macedonia. The father of one of the victims spoke through an interpreter.
It's my only child, and he died. What am I supposed to do?
The BBC's Guy Delaney on the possible cause.
The band were using some on-stage pyrotechnics, and sparks from those pyrotechnics set a fire off in the ceiling. From video footage, you can see the flames creeping across the ceiling, and people, presumably staff, using fire extinguishers in an attempt to put them out.
President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin are expected to speak this week amid ongoing talks about ending the Russia-Ukraine war. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on CBS's Face the Nation.
If Putin is sincere about wanting peace, accept the ceasefire on the same terms as Ukraine and quit trying to mix the two, ceasefire and peace deal.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. A new report commissioned by faith leaders outlines the high moral stakes at play as the Trump administration pushes to cut federal programs to pay for extending tax cuts passed in 2017. Here's Eric Galatis.
Co-author Karen Dolan with the Institute for Policy Studies says the budget resolution recently passed by the U.S. House would eviscerate Medicaid, the single largest source of health coverage in the U.S., by cutting $880 billion.
The proposal could result in a loss of coverage for 36 million people.
Republicans have long argued that tax cuts boost the economy and allow people to keep more of the money they earn. Extending tax cuts would amount to less than a dollar per day in savings for the bottom half of U.S. families, but the richest 0.1% of Americans would receive over $314,000. Corporations promised to use windfalls from tax cuts in 2017 to raise wages, but Dolan notes the bottom 90% of workers have seen no benefits at all.
When corporations get huge windfalls in the form of tax breaks and tax loopholes, that money does not trickle down to workers' wages or to the economy. All it does is enrich that corporation. operation.
The GOP also plans to cut food assistance by $230 billion and increase work requirements. Dolan says the majority of people who receive assistance are already working.
92% of people who receive Medicaid work either full-time or half-time, or have disabilities, are over age 65, are taking care of children or elderly adults, or are attending school.
This is Eric Galatis. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly sunny and a little breezy today, a high near 40. Partly cloudy tonight, lows upper 20s. Much warmer Monday, upper 50s with sun. Mild again Tuesday, but the wind picks back up. Rain and snow Tuesday night and Wednesday. Current temp is 30.
Maggie Dawn.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, everybody. We've got a whole show dedicated to the holiday. We're going to be talking about Irish heritage. We've got live Irish music. We'll explain what the heck curling is. Don't miss it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. And my name is Jim Santel, and I am your host. This hour and also next hour, our two-hour weekly weekend broadcast all about the rule of law, about justice, about the aspiration for justice in America and beyond, about things that are important to our lives and livelihoods, especially true this week as we focus once again upon the Department of Justice and the executive branch. We invite you this weekend, as always, in our weekend review of justice-related issues to join in our conversation, be a part of this discussion. You can call in. You can also drop texts into our box at 855-752-4842. That phone number, once again, is 855-752-4842. Along with my terrific producer, Max, here in the studios of Civic Media in Racine, Wisconsin, taking your thoughts, your perspectives, your questions, your inquiries about many things on our aggressive but achievable agenda this weekend, inviting you to participate in our discussion. And yes, indeed, focusing, as we often do, on the issues and events and significant developments coming out of the United States Department of Justice, not just in past years, but especially in this term, as the Department of Justice takes on an entirely new cast, an entirely new approach and atmosphere when it comes to serving you, the American people. And once again, important to underscore, to highlight this notion at the very top of our broadcast this weekend, that the Department of Justice is your Department of Justice. The people, the attorneys, the staff, the investigators, the agents, the paralegals, all the people who are involved in the Department of Justice, yes, indeed, a branch of the executive of the United States of America, around the cabinet table sits, among others, the Attorney General of the United States of America, but not beholden, not the attorneys of the president, contrary to what our Attorney General Pam Bondi said just on Friday of this past week. In fact, the Department of Justice serving you and advancing the interests of America in pursuit of justice. Significantly, this broadcast, spending most of our first hour, and again, inviting your questions, your comments, your reactions to all of this, necessarily focusing on something that rarely happens in American history. It happened on Friday of this past week, and that is that a president of the United States of America left the White House and took the very brief trip, just a few blocks down Pennsylvania Avenue, arriving at the Department of Justice located at 9th and Pennsylvania, right along that street where you see the presidents routinely now after inaugurations, not this past time, but routinely walking down Pennsylvania Avenue after they're inaugurated. They pass right by the United States Department of Justice. The Department of Justice, again, a building right there on Pennsylvania Avenue, about halfway between the White House to the west and the Capitol building to the east. This bastion of justice, this place where justice should be considered, meted out, ensured for all Americans. Also the place yesterday where the president of the United States of America, his name is Donald John Trump, appeared in the Great Hall of the Department of Justice and delivered a speech that was unlike anything we have seen before in the many decades since the Department of Justice has had that venue right there on Pennsylvania Avenue. Certainly unprecedented in the history of relations between a president and the Department of Justice ever since the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office was created way back in 1789 by the Judiciary Act of that time. 1792, Congress made the Attorney General a cabinet-level post. Yesterday, Donald Trump, our president, visited the Department of Justice. Not unprecedented. It has been done before. It has been done in times when presidents decide that it is appropriate to visit this place, this hallowed, this sacred place of justice in our history and in our present contemporary life to deliver a speech, talking, as we often do on this broadcast, about the aspirations that he, perhaps one day she, has for America, talking about the reasons why we do justice, why we do criminal prosecution, why we do civil litigation, all of it not animated by any individual, any personal interest, certainly not a part of a retributive attitude toward justice, but to advance the goals and purposes of justice, to ensure that civil rights are enforced, environmental laws are enforced, yes, antitrust laws and tax laws are enforced, that the civil rights that you have under statutes and the Constitution are ensured, and that the people of the Department of Justice understand that they have that role to play independent of the specific direction of a president. Not inappropriate at all, as we have talked at great length in the past, for a president to describe in general terms the things that he anticipates the attorney general will do during the course of a term of the presidency. Not inappropriate at all, for example, for a president to talk about a focus upon antitrust, business issues, environmental issues, agricultural issues, labor issues, civil rights, human rights issues, national security, public integrity, all kinds of things that animate the Department of Justice in the early part of the 21st century and even long before that. Not inappropriate at all for an attorney general to hear from a president, for all of the U.S. attorneys, all the assistant United States attorneys around the country, all of the professional staff, and yes, indeed, these are civil servants. They're working on your behalf. They do not bring to their daily work a political animus, a political drive of any kind. All of them, appropriately, from time to time, hearing from your president about the broad strokes, the broad missions that the president envisions for the Department of Justice, what a president does not do, should not do, has not done, with a couple of rare exceptions, one of them being Donald Trump, the other one being Richard Nixon. What a president does not do is he does not direct an attorney general, assistant United States attorneys, U.S. attorneys to prosecute particular individuals, to go after particular companies civilly or criminally. The specifics are left to the independent judgment, discretion of assistant United States attorneys, and yes, of the attorney general and of the deputy attorney general and of assistant attorneys general responsible for all kinds of things inside the department to do what? Not to take direction from a department of the president that animates the Department of Justice, but rather to be animated by the law and the facts, to apply the law to the facts and determine whether or not there should be lawsuits filed, criminal or civil. Yesterday, all of that turned on its head. The president initially told through the media sources at the White House that he was going to announce the reinvocation of the statute that, yes, is still out there, invoked just a handful of times in American history, among other things, to support during World War II the horrific, the now generally debunked and rejected notion that Japanese Americans during the Second World War in our nation should be interned in camps, basically prison camps in the western portion of our nation, because we did not trust, apparently, their allegiance and their focus upon the United States of America. American citizens put in prison effectively. Long, long since put back behind us, told that even the Supreme Court case, Karamatsu, that supported that particular horrific event in our American history has since been rejected. White House telling us that the president was going to announce that he was going to revive that particular statute and invoke it in some ways. He did not do that, which is perhaps the only positive news that comes out of yesterday's Friday's story of his visit to Maine Justice. But he did other things in what are many ways, a political statement of the sort that we've gotten used to in his campaigns for the presidency. This was more an attack upon various people with whom he has had disagreements, an attack upon the media, attack upon attorneys, an attack upon former Department of Justice officials, an attack upon anyone who would stand in his way, and calling effectively upon the Department of Justice there in the great hall of the Department of Justice, gathered together there to hear the mission, the purpose, the focus of the president, calling upon all of the Department of Justice implicitly and explicitly to follow his lead. Before we get to the specifics of that and record here, it is important to do so. It is important for all of us to appreciate the horrors of what happened yesterday, even in the nature of words. Yes, indeed, words mean something, as we've often said. Language has meaning. And yesterday, the meanings coming from our president are unmistakable. Before we get to that, let's talk about the setting itself. We've talked in previous broadcasts about the importance of understanding something inside the Department of Justice, about its structure. Where does the Attorney General sit at the top of the Department of Justice? Who is the Deputy Attorney General? Who are these Assistant Attorneys General who operate the various litigating units in the Department of Justice? What about the investigative agencies like the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service? We've talked all about that. Today, seemingly a bit more superficial, but nonetheless very important because of the important messages that even the architecture of the building conveys, even the building itself conveys. We're going to talk about the building itself there on 9th and Constitution, 9th and Pennsylvania, right there adjacent to the mall in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, the U.S. Department of Justice building, now called the Robert F. Kennedy Department of Justice building. Interestingly, and importantly, historically important to note, that it was under the presidency of George W. Bush that the building was renamed in honor of Robert F. Kennedy, who again served as the Attorney General from 1961 to 1964. George W. Bush did that, proclaiming again that this would be the RFK Justice Department. What do we know about the Department of Justice building itself there right on Pennsylvania Avenue? Again, it's the kind of building that you would not necessarily visit. In fact, you really can't visit. It's not on the list of tourist attractions. But it is significant, as I will note, as you walk around that building the next time you're in Washington, D.C., to take a look at the purposeful design of that building and the things that are inscribed outside of the building. Those you can see. And if you are lucky enough to have some reason to go inside, if you make arrangements with someone to come inside the building, you will also note the affirmations of justice inside every single hallway in the Department of Justice. Way back in 1908 and again in 1928, the Congress authorized the purchase of some land. At the time, it was not entirely vacant, but right there on Pennsylvania Avenue, known as Federal Triangle. Those of you who've been in Washington, D.C. know that well. That's where the Department of Justice presently is located. As Amicus Law Review continues, I'll tell you more about the building of that Department of Justice and the important, significant symbols of your place of justice in Washington, D.C. All that coming up here on Amicus Law Review.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Time for the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. A Wisconsin judge has affirmed that Canadian oil giant Enbridge must pause construction on its Line 5 pipeline while a legal challenge plays out. Conservation groups are suing to block state permits that would allow the company to clear trees, dig trenches, and fill wetlands in northern Wisconsin, all to make way for a new 41-mile section of the pipeline that carries Canadian crude oil to refineries in Ontario. Republicans and Democrats in Wisconsin coming together to support livestock grazing on our farms. State lawmakers introduced the Transition to Grazing bill that will help our farmers improve soil, water quality, and livestock health by getting dairy cows and other animals out of the barns and out grazing on grass in the spring and summertime. For a deep dive into environmental issues and what you can do to protect Wisconsin's water, air, and land, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review, our weekly weekend review of all things justice-related, rule of law-related, including especially this broadcast, as we take our assessment of what the President of the United States of America did and said just on Friday of this week, a virtually unprecedented nature of his address to members of the Department of Justice gathered in the Great Hall, this major majestic hall. I will describe that in just a moment. To give us some sense about what his animus is toward people out there, the retribution that he is going to visit upon Americans, it is stunning. It is shocking. It is completely incongruous with the very purposes and visions and missions of the Department of Justice, not only in terms of the creation of this department, but the building itself in every single aspect speaks about things that are so much more lofty, so much more important, so much beyond what my president said yesterday in the Department of Justice, that the news story itself about his presence there, his visit, cannot, the importance of it cannot be overstated. Again, in 1930, after Congress previously had purchased this plot of land right there on Pennsylvania Avenue, Congress appropriated a whopping, in today's dollars, $10 million. $10 million for the construction, finally, of a permanent Department of Justice headquarters right there in the Federal Triangle. Again, you walk by it every time you're walking down the main thoroughfare there between the Capitol building and the White House, Pennsylvania Avenue. The Department of Justice is there. It's been there since 1935. 1% of the cost of the construction was for art. And that's important because there was a conscious decision made at the time of the architectural design, the construction, the development of the building to ensure that the messages of justice oozed from every single piece of structure in the building. Between 1935 and 1941, 68 murals, 68 different murals were painted in the building. It was an example of New Deal art, which you probably know much about. So what else do we know about the Department of Justice? Again, in addition to the fact that it's now called the RFK building, and George W. Bush, the one who did that on November 20th of 2001 in recognition of the service of Robert F. Kennedy as our attorney general way back in the early 1960s. The design of the building took its influences from a neoclassical, sort of a Greek revival practice and policy, and Art Deco architectural also. The design was similar to many other buildings you also see there along Pennsylvania Avenue and Federal Triangle. It has an Indiana limestone facade from right here in the Midwest. It covers a steel frame. It's got some red tile roof and some colonnades throughout the building as well. It's got these wonderful interior courtyards that were intended to provide what? Light and ventilation and convey the sense of an open and transparent aspect of justice, even inside the building itself. Significantly, one of two inscriptions I'm going to tell you about, you can see many of them. They're blazoned all over the outside of the building. One of them, one of my two favorites, is this. The inscription on one of the sides of the RFK Department of Justice building, again, designed and then constructed, finally opened in 1935, is this. It says, "Justice is founded in the rights bestowed by nature upon man. Liberty is maintained in security of justice. In other words, justice supports our liberty. Justice is founded upon rights that are known to all of us. Message on the exterior of the Department of Justice, completely contrary to what the President of the United States of America said in that hallowed place, in this important place where justice is administered every single day. Now, significantly as well, one of the things you will note that makes it unlike some of the other buildings in the federal triangle is just this. Many of them were cast in bronze. There are various aspects of sculptures and other doors and things. Supreme Court, for example, has these big bronze doors there up on Capitol Hill, the Commerce Building, all kinds of things there. Even the Chase Manhattan Bank, not too far from that. Lots of things having to do with kind of traditional metals used. The decision was made at the time of the Department of Justice construction to use aluminum. And indeed, you can see that metal blazoned on the exterior and also the interior of the building, quite literally up and down the staircases of it and many interior distinctive spaces, including the Great Hall itself. The Great Hall itself that has these Art Deco light features, terracotta tile floors, gray marble borders, and also the law library, which is upstairs. It's located on the fifth floor. It's a two-story room. It's also distinguished by some wonderful Art Deco panels and, again, emblazoned with signs and signals about what justice is supposed to mean for all Americans. The interior of the U.S. Department of Justice contains many decorative wall paintings. They were purposely designed, these murals, to depict what scenes of daily life. And what was the point of that? It was to ensure that there is a connection between the daily life of people in America and what goes on in that building, the administering and the promotion of justice. Throughout American history, an awful lot of reminiscences about where we have been, symbolic interpretations or allegories relating to what? To the role of justice in our system and the role that lawyers play, and lawyers who are committed not to a particular president, but committed to serving the American public. In all, there are 68 different murals completed between 1935 and 1941, cost a whopping $68,000, again, 1% of the cost of the building. Those artists included George Biddle, Henry Varnum Poor, John Stuart Curry, Boardman Robinson, Emil Bistrom, and Leon Kroll. You may recognize some of those artists. It is fantastic art commissioned, again, to send the message to anybody who's inside the department and those who are outside of it along the Pennsylvania Avenue, 9th and 10th Street, Constitution on the other side, all of them to know that this is a special place. Those striking mosaics on the ceilings, on the walls, all of them convey this important notion about the Department of Justice. And then we have the Great Hall. And that is the place where the President of the United States of America on Friday delivered this horrific speech that basically did not acknowledge anything about what the building itself is about, what justice is all about, but another rant. Another campaign-type rant against all the people who, in his perspective, have done him wrong. The spirit of justice, this lofty, amazing cast aluminum Art Deco statue is designed by an architect named Genowine. It depicts Lady Justice. It's a woman wearing a toga-like dress. It stands on huge display along with a male counterpart called the Majesty of Law in the Great Hall. You probably have seen some pictures of it. You can go online and see these majestic statues again. And designed to promote the visual importance of what goes on there. Unlike many representations of Lady Justice, the spirit of justice standing there in the Great Hall has no blindfold on to symbol blind justice. And that was also intentional. The notion that, yes, indeed, there should be lawyers and there should be practitioners, civil litigants and criminal prosecutors who are visually attuned to the facts around them, the life circumstances around them. The statutes, both of them, the Majesty of Law and the Spirit of Justice, they measure 12.5 feet. And they were commissioned in 1933 at a cost of $7,000. They stand there in the Great Hall since 1936. All of that a part of what's happening inside the Department of Justice. We know as well that it was there in the Great Hall that Donald Trump yesterday spent a huge amount of time talking about what he viewed the Department of Justice is all about. We'll get to that right after this as the broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media as Amicus Law Review continues. Stay with us.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. It was a terrifying weekend for those who live in parts of the central and southern U.S. as a string of tornadoes touched down. Jerrica McCoy's home was hit in Tylertown, Mississippi.
I grabbed my toddler, wrapped her up, and got on the bed, and then my husband grabbed my daughter. All I could hear is my six-year-old screaming that she didn't want to die. You don't want to hear that coming out of your baby's mouth.
More watches are posted from Pennsylvania to Florida. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin are expected to speak this week about ending the Russia-Ukraine war. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz on ABC.
We are now driving both sides together to achieve a permanent peace, stop the killing.
A SpaceX capsule has arrived at the International Space Station with replacements for NASA's two stuck astronauts. Suni Williams is one of them.
It was a wonderful day. Great to see our friends arrive.
She has spent 9 months in space. CBS News Brief, I'm Wendy Gillette.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
The Bucks beat the Pacers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. NBA Bucks with a win last night over the Pacers, 126-119. Milwaukee able to hold on to fourth place in the Eastern Conference, one game ahead of Indianapolis. Tonight, the Bucks host the Thunder in prime time, tip off at 8 o'clock. Men's college basketball, the Badgers with an upset win, 77-74 over Michigan State. The Spartans, the number one seed, knocked out of the Big Ten tournament. Head coach Tom Izzo.
Well, I'm disappointed, and little things can make a difference. We preach that all the time, but sometimes, you know, it doesn't go through.
The Badgers now play this afternoon in the finals against the Michigan Wolverines. Greg Gard on getting past the Spartans.
One heck of a college basketball game. Two really good teams, two really high-level programs that have been, you know, in this position a lot. Obviously, I have great respect for Tom and his program, and, you know, in order to compete at this level this time of the year, you got to play your rear end off, and I thought both teams did.
That's Wisconsin head coach Greg Gard with sports on Mike Clemens.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly sunny and a little breezy today, a high near 40. Partly cloudy tonight, lows upper 20s. Much warmer Monday, upper 50s with sun. Mild again Tuesday, but the wind picks back up. Rain and snow Tuesday night and Wednesday.
Right now it's 31.
You want to feel important. You want to be a part of something bigger, something that matters and can help change things. You want to feel like you belong. We know. We felt that way too. And that's why we did something about it. We aren't just Army National Guard soldiers. We are normal people just like you. And together, we can make a difference. Take on your legacy. Visit NationalGuard.com to find out more.
Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. More Trump administration mass layoffs at CISA have experts raising concerns over U.S. readiness for cyber attacks on election infrastructure and federal agency networks. An additional 100 in-house and contracted cyber specialists were reportedly terminated in March. The terminations raised the number of layoffs at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency to an estimated 300, though new CISA leadership has denied recent layoffs. As we reported in February, a team assisting state election officials in improving and hardening election systems was laid off. VoteBeat reported March 11th that CISA's new leadership informed state election officials that it had suspended operations and funding for the Election Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center. In addition, a McCarthy-like effort is underway to purge CISA staffers who ran 2020 efforts to combat foreign and domestic disinformation in social media, some concocted by the Trump campaign and its allies. Reports in cybersecurity journals say that the latest layoffs involve so-called red teams, which pressure test the security of government networks. CBS News quoted one cybersecurity expert let go in February as saying about U.S. networks, "We're being targeted daily, hourly, and every single minute." We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, a person with MS and autism and is an advocate for Medicare and Medicaid will join us. Going to be a very interesting conversation. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and also next hour on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, joined in the Civic Media studios by my producer, Max, and together we're taking your phone calls and your comments, both in the Dropbox and also call in. Be a part of the discussion, 855-752-4842. Necessarily talking on Amicus Law Review this weekend about one of the most stunning events in American history, the visit by a sitting president to the Department of Justice, completely contrary to what all his predecessors have done, and upsetting, frankly, well, decades and decades of understandings about the relationship, the arm's length relationship between the Department of Justice and the presidency. Even for Donald Trump, even his standards, this was a stunning show, a stunning, shocking show of disregard for decades, those decades of tradition by his predecessors, who often worried, Republicans and Democrats alike, others who preceded Republicans and Democrats, they worried about politicizing, appearing to be exerting way too much authority, too much control over the nation's most powerful law enforcement agency, not this president. Trump instead called himself the chief law enforcement officer in our country. Technically not true, not true. That's the attorney general. He has certainly supervisory responsibilities here. And then accused the Department of Justice's prior leadership, presumably that of Joe Biden and those before him, of doing, quote, everything within their power to prevent him from becoming the president. Stunning, stunning in many, many ways for a man who long ago has dispensed of this notion. Certainly was true in his first term. He has completely abandoned it now in his second term, the notion of an independent Department of Justice that, yes, can take general acceptances of views and perspectives and missions and purposes from a president, but does not get involved. A president does not get involved in designing particular criminal prosecutions and particular civil cases. For a president who long dispensed with all of that, it is gone in America. That norm, that standard of behavior that has animated virtually all previous administrations, that's gone. Even for this president, it was an expression this past week of conquest. We have now conquered through the works that we have done through the election of November of last year, a vindication of all that he has said. And that was the spirit. That was the mission. That was the purpose of what he was all about. He said, is it appropriate that I do this? That I come here to the Department of Justice and make this speech? He was asking the department officials who were there. And then he said, and then I realized it's not only appropriate, I think it's really important that he do just that. So what, in fact, did he say? Well, it was broad-based. It was about an hour-long rambling, incoherent in many ways, as is often the expression of Donald Trump. Along the way, some language that is not common to anyone who has addressed a group inside that august hall called Great Hall inside Main Justice. He attacked the media, CNN, MSNBC, newspapers generally. They're the enemy, once again, of the people, as he said previously on Friday, describing them as corrupt and illegal, somehow illegal. Contrary, of course, to what the First Amendment of the Constitution says all about the legitimacy of our media and the importance of an independent press. He attacked individuals. He attacked a group called the Contrarian News Service, a Cruz News Service that provides, yes, indeed, perspectives that Donald Trump does not like, attacked many other people, and basically called upon the Department of Justice to go after them. He described them repeatedly as being illegal, being corrupt, being contrary to the basic tenets of our nation when it comes to news and sharing information completely contrary to what was envisioned by our founding fathers, not just in the Constitution, but as they explained it in the Federalist Papers, as the Supreme Court, as every other federal court and state court in America, has reaffirmed the legitimacy of independent news agencies. Yes, indeed, to be critical, to be a part of the process that prompts, again, in the marketplace of ideas, as the Supreme Court once described it, attacking our president was all of those institutions, electronic media, print media, people online, people with broadcasts of great fame, those who are not in the general attention of America, many of them, if not all of them, who would take a different view than that of our president, now in his eyesight, condemning them and indicating that's his opinion, that they're illegal and that they plainly should go away. Along the way, he makes reference to his attorney general, deputy attorney general, Todd Blanche, who is also right there. He calls him Todd and sort of a wink to him says, yes, we need to get about going after this part of American society, a free press that has been stopping apparently the American public from understanding accurately what's going on. In fact, Mr. President, just the opposite. Scum. He called his adversaries scum. In the same room where Attorney General Robert Jackson in 1940 delivered just the opposite kind of a speech. I'm going to get to that in just a few moments or so. He called his adversaries scum. He delivered this speech, free association, once again, word salad. Message, however, was unmistakable. The president unmistakably intends to bend these vast powers of federal law enforcement, now vested in his attorney general, Pam Bondi, his deputy attorney, his former counsel in criminal cases named Todd Blanche, in the pursuit of, yes, an anti-crime agenda, but perhaps also more importantly, a vengeance agenda. He said this. He said, in recent years, unfortunately, a corrupt group of hacks and radicals within the ranks of the American government obliterated the trust and the goodwill built up over generations. Well, that trust and goodwill was, in fact, built up, Mr. President, but you're destroying it. And went on to say they weaponized the vast powers of our intelligence and law enforcement agencies to try and thwart the will of the American people. He implored, he urged, he commanded his political appointees right there in the room and beyond not to be, as he said, deflected by critics in enforcing his agenda. Again, the politicization of the Department of Justice there, unmistakable. He suggested that he was preparing a new executive order, a series of actions to personally target what he called the violent, vicious lawyers who prosecuted him or opposed his policies in court. We're going to talk later on in the broadcast about his attack upon lawyers, private attorneys, who, again, are part of our system of justice in America. He said, we're turning the page on four long years of corruption, weaponization, and surrender to violent criminals. He talked about how violence in America was at all-time highs, simply wrong. And if he were to stop and visit across the street at the FBI, the main FBI headquarters there, the J. Edgar Hoover building, it's that very modern-like looking building, very much unlike the Department of Justice building built in 1935. He'd stop by the FBI. They would tell him that, indeed, in virtually all areas, crime has been down, trending down in America, not what he said yesterday. And he said, we're restoring fair, equal, and impartial justice. That's what the president said yesterday from the Great Hall, as standing by a lectern that was flanked by signs reading Fighting Fentanyl. Didn't comment at all about that particular focus of the Department of Justice. He also heaped praise along at least one of his appointees to the federal bench. He said he doesn't know her, never met her. Her name is Eileen Cannon. She, you recall, is the judge who dismissed that case, that Mar-a-Lago documents case against him. Over the handling of those classified and other national security documents, calling her the absolute model of what a judge should be. And that's also a part of his practice, as we know. If you run afoul of him, you get criticized. And indeed, you're in the target of retribution, as he announced yesterday explicitly, unconditionally, and you are on his side, you get praise. He said the case against me was, and I'm not going to repeat the word that he used, but he said it was something, standing in the building where the charges against him were actually approved by the Department of Justice. And we know, of course, that presidents have their opportunities throughout their terms to express views on things that happen in America, including Supreme Court cases. This went far beyond that. The president also, of course, followed this presentation by two others who he had also appointed recently. Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general, was there. He offered sort of a cheerful, cherry-picked recitation of the department's accomplishments thus far, the acceleration of immigration enforcement, efforts to punish academic institutions that somehow choose not to bow to the administration's demand to purge, yes, that's right, diversity and inclusion programs, intensifying efforts to fight fentanyl trafficking. And that's good. That's good that the deputy attorney general responsible for the day-to-day operation would talk about at least that last focus on addressing the problem of drugs in America. Todd Blanche, again, began by expressing his commitment to upholding the best traditions of the department. He knows them because he was there before. He was a former prosecutor, but he quickly shifted gears to profess once again what Donald Trump insists of all of his appointees, including this one, with whom he used to have just a couple of weeks ago, several months ago, an attorney-client relationship. He professed, that is, Todd Blanche, the deputy attorney general, his undying personal loyalty to the president, something that none of his predecessors in any administration have ever done. Mr. Trump, Todd Blanche said, the number two at the Department of Justice is a complete inspiration to me. That's what the deputy attorney general said. Pam Bondi was also there, again, along with the FBI director, Kash Patel, likewise heaping praise upon this president, echoed Mr. Blanche, and she called Donald Trump the greatest president in the history of our country. And here's the, whether you agree with that or not, it got even more troubling. She went on to say this. She said she works, implicitly, she said all of the Department of Justice works at the directive of Donald Trump. Those were her words, not mine. The directive of Donald Trump. Again, another nod to the Trump presidency being in control of the Justice Department. Shocking, shocking in terms of the ways in which these messages were conveyed, the substance of them, not a policy speech, not at all the kind of thing that we would anticipate from a president who is there, number one, to outline his plans in the next 4 years for a Department of Justice that fires on all these important Justice Department cylinders, including antitrust and the environment and education and labor and national security and civil rights and human rights and everything else that the Department of Justice is responsible for in terms of promoting the interests of justice. Didn't do that at all yesterday. Didn't talk about specific designs and plans that he had for the future of America. Talked about getting back at the people who have wronged him in his views, talked about retribution, and invited the Department of Justice to do that on his behalf, received from the leadership of the Department of Justice a commitment to do that. This speech and the response it got should be the source of tremendous concern and even more outrage in the midst of all the outrage of the past couple of months, even more outrage because of the nature of it and the ways in which the messages were conveyed. Witness what happened in 1940. Robert Jackson, 5 years into the occupying of this wonderful, amazing building there on Pennsylvania Avenue. Robert Jackson would go on to be on the Supreme Court, but at the time he was the Attorney General of the United States of America. Witness what Robert Jackson said again in that great hall, that very place where Donald Trump was standing on Friday. Robert Jackson, then the Attorney General, the chief federal law enforcement officer, said this. He said, the qualities of a good prosecutor are as elusive and as impossible to define as those which mark a gentleman. He went on to say, and those who need to be told would not understand it anyway. Attorney General Robert Jackson went on to say, a sensitivity to fair play and sportsmanship is perhaps the best protection against the abuse of power. And the citizen's safety lies in the prosecutor who tempers zeal with human kindness, who seeks truth and not victims, who serves the law and not factional purposes, and who approaches his task with humility. I hope that should inspire all of us these decades later. That was 1940, Robert Jackson, the Attorney General. Contrast that with what our president said in that same place, in that same hallowed hall at Main Justice just on Friday of this past week, and know that it will animate going forward what this Justice Department does through the FBI, the other agencies, the investigative agencies, under the supervision of the Attorney General, an Attorney General who, again, on Friday, pledged her complete allegiance, not to you, not to the people of America, not to our nation, its future, its present, but rather to the White House and to the Attorney General. When we return, a final comment about this, again, hearkening back to what's on the outside of the Department of Justice, and then also taking calls and reciting some of the texts we're getting about this very important issue in American history, this event that happened in America just this past week here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Celebrate the women who have helped shape the world as we honor Women's History Month with powerful stories of Wisconsin's own. We recognize the groundbreaking achievements of Elizabeth Bayard. She defied the odds to become the first female journalist in Northeast Wisconsin. It was the mid-1800s. Bayard was considered a trusted voice as she wrote about the developing area of the territory known as Green Bay. Her reporting revealed the stories of women and families, offering a fresh perspective in a male-dominated press at that time. Perseverance, passion, and breaking barriers. Bayard is a part of Green Bay and Wisconsin history, and a symbol of the progress women continue to make every day. We recognize the powerful women from the past and those who are still writing their own history today. I'm Lisa Hale.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review, necessarily out of complete obligation to our purpose, which is to be a friend of the community, getting some sense about what's going on in the world of justice in America and beyond, necessarily talking about this horrific, this terrible address given by the President of the United States of America at the Department of Justice, not defining any of his visions or his missions for the Department of Justice, but in many ways reminiscent of what he did on the campaign trail, an attack upon various people, including the media, prompting Mark to send in a note saying Trump is likely even more thin-skinned than John Adams was, who also hated a free press. The press of the time was equally, if not more, partisan. Federalists and Democratic Republican papers taking positions on issues. Mark, appreciate that comment as well. And noting, as I said at the outset, that as you walk by the Department of Justice, strongly encouraging you the next time you're in Washington, D.C., as you're walking up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, take a moment. It doesn't take long to circle 9th and 10th and Pennsylvania Constitution. Look up. Look up at the Department of Justice building itself and see all of these amazingly important statements about law and justice in America purposely emblazoned on the side of the building. This is my favorite. It's at the very corner of 9th and Pennsylvania, just across from the FBI building. And a little bit paraphrased because the language is a little bit arcane. It says this. It says this, and it goes to the question of what do we do about all this? What do we do about all of the concerns we've had, not just this speech, but all the other things going on? The Department of Justice, they're right on Pennsylvania Avenue. The building itself tells us this. It says, before justice can exist in the conduct and the conscience of a government, before justice can exist in the conduct and the conscience of a government, it must first reside in the hearts and souls of its citizens. Before justice can exist in the conduct and conscience of a government, it must first reside in the hearts and the souls of its citizens. Before we can expect that a Department of Justice, a government, a White House, any trappings of our government are conducting themselves in a way that's proper, consistent with the Constitution, that they have, yes, a conscience, a governmental conscience, those things have to first reside in our hearts and souls. And that I would offer to you all on this broadcast of Amicus as a call to work to toward those ends. It is up to us. Our hearts and souls need to animate what we do next. We're the ones who can push back on these horrific messages being given by our president, by our attorney general, and by so many other cabinet officers, officials now of the government, invested with authority, but apparently not the conduct and the conscience that really is ours. In our hearts and souls need to adopt what it says there. Before justice can exist in the conduct and conscience of a government, of our government at any time, it has to reside first in our hearts and souls, and we need to act on that. Appreciate, as I said, greatly, comments on the Dropbox. Also, callers calling in our broadcast, and that includes you, Joe, from Madison. Joe, thanks for joining us again in our discussion today.
Thanks, Jim. I don't think we can talk about this enough because it's really unparalleled. This guy just blowing his top and trashing our First Amendment, First Amendment. So I wanted to just bring up briefly, yesterday I had talked with you about on another show, the Devil's Advocate show, the Dom show. And my question was this question of, there's a nonprofit group called Crew that he went after,
right.
And he described the person who ran that as, quote, violent.
Yes,
and then he
yes.
used language of being illegal against CNN. These things are, we determined, are defamatory. He is
yes.
trashing them, and that creates not only a reputational harm, and that reputational harm can be expressed in loss of business, all sorts of things. So my question for you is, though, I was thinking about it later. If you were to bring defamation charges against the president, really an unprecedented thing to do, in this president, with this Supreme Court saying he's not liable for anything, he's the president, he can get away with what he wants to, what redress do these people have to say, you have trashed our reputation, you have defamed us, now what? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that matter, and maybe you can't get to them now, next hour, whenever. Thanks very much, Jim.
Joe, thanks so much for the comment. And yes, indeed, Joe, your points are not only well taken, but they do invoke recent history. You know, there has been some success, right? I think in the broadcast yesterday, when I was appearing with Dom Salvia on his afternoon show, we talked about E. Jean Carroll, who was defamed by this president during the course of his first term when he's called her a liar about what happened to her, the sexual assault of her many years ago in the 1990s when he attacked her in that store in Manhattan. Defamed her, and yes, indeed, juries, this isn't a court. This wasn't Joe Biden. This was a court and a jury in particular brought together, and they found defamation there, imposed judgments, multiple jury verdicts against him, again, alleging defamation. It is possible to do it. Again, we know that in the wake of that, as you just indicated, Joe, the Supreme Court basically saying the presidents can't be entangled with things like that. But the law of defamation presumably still applies to a president. Again, in the interest of a little bit of civics here, a little bit of law school, which we sometimes do, amicus, friend of the community, doing some teaching, some instruction here, defamation. Plaintiff generally needs to remove a false statement of fact. And again, Joe, this reference of the president to these various entities, one individual in particular being violent, is presumably talking about physical violence, simply completely wrong, unsupported. A false statement of fact being made, published to some third parties, absolutely published not just to the Department of Justice, but to 334 million people in America, and also causing harm to reputation. Joe, as you just indicated, that's the kind of thing that can indeed harm reputation. The Dominion lawsuit, the Dominion voting machines lawsuit against Fox News, this is kind of a reverse media case. They also got a huge judgment against Fox News. Why? Because Fox News was saying things were simply wrong about the operation and the conduct of those machines. When a president gets up and says things that are overtly false statements, knows what he's doing, does so either out of malice or negligence, and has that impact, the statement is false and affects the reputation, those are the elements of a defamation lawsuit. And I would like to believe that the America, and Joe, I think you do, and virtually all of our listeners do, like to think that the America that we know and that we regard still with great honor does still have a defamation law that could apply to the presidency of the United States of America. Important notion to keep in mind. Important notion also to note that it's the New York Times versus Sullivan in the other direction. In the other direction, the president complaining, as Joe just indicated once again, about media. The only basis upon which to go after the media is if they show express malice, hatred, knowing that the things that they're publishing are wrong and doing it out of malice. That's the New York Times versus Sullivan standard. When we come back here in Amicus, we're going to do a little bit more talking about what happened this past week. Again, taking your phone calls, taking your comments, which we appreciate tremendously here on our discussion forum, which is Amicus, a law review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, we talk aliens with paranormal investigator Todd Michaels, and Flicks Brewhouse brewmaster Dave Hansen joins the show to talk about the new Nightlight beer. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates, as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap,
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Wendy Gillette. Parts of West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania are on watch for possible tornadoes from a strong storm system that has already killed at least 36 people in seven states. National Weather Service meteorologist David Roth.
The highest risk of severe weather is in West Pennsylvania. That would include Pittsburgh and Erie, and be not that far south of Buffalo either.
12 of the storm deaths were in Missouri. Governor Mike Kehoe.
Along with the damage and the sadness, we've seen some Missouri greatness as well. Friends helping friends, neighbors helping neighbors, people helping each other they never met before.
The whipping winds fanned over 100 wildfires burning in Oklahoma. KOTV's Craig Day spoke to a family in Manford.
After a sleepless night worrying about their homes, their hope turns to heartache. It's hard to fight back tears when you've lost everything. Marty and Sandra Snyder.